a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on First Lady and Friends, we had an incredibly special guest. Her name is Elizabeth Smart. I'm sure you all know her. We had a great conversation about how her experience has propelled her forward in her advocacy and about parenthood and all the things that she's doing now. Can't wait for you to take a listen. Let's get proximate. We are here on First Lady and Friends with a very special guest, someone that I have met before, but I am so excited to get to know better. We have Elizabeth Smart here in our studio to talk to us today. We're so glad you're here, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. And so many people know you, and you've done some incredible work in the advocacy space. But before we get into all that, I would love to talk about your family. Talk to me about your kiddos and your husband and how are they doing and what's going on in your world.
My family's great. I have three kids, girl, boy, girl, 7, 5, and 3. And I mean, it's summer, so life's a little chaotic. I mean, they all wanted to come down here today, and I had to convince them that that wasn't a good idea, but they thought I was wrong. So they're definitely upset that they're not here right now. So I'll definitely have to go make it up to them later. But no, it's great. They're the best part of my life and probably the most exhausting part of my life. And then, yeah, my husband, he's great and nothing quite like a Utah summer.
Yeah. So where are you now?
We're in the Wasatch back.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
We love it.
So beautiful.
There. Yeah.
We were just up there last week. Up by Camas, just past Camas. And oh my goodness, it's just beautiful up there this time of year.
It is. Not that I don't love Salt Lake, I do, you know, yeah. Born and raised Salt Lake City. But now that I've made the jump to the Wasatch back, I don't know if I will ever come back down to the Wasatch front.
Yeah. And I think so many people there, because it's growing so much there. And I think people have just... When I was growing up, we played a lot of, you know, like South Summit and North Summit. When I was in high school, we would travel all the way up there from Sanpete County, from North Sanpete, to play them. And it was just so small. And now it's growing so much up there.
Yeah, but I mean, we love it. I've been, you know, Park City, Midway, all in that area for the last 10 years. And I love it back there.
Yeah, it's so great. And your kids, how are they liking school? Is it are you happy with their education and what's going on there?
My daughter's going into second grade and my little boy's going into kindergarten. So far so good. ask me in a couple more years and I will let you know.
Yeah, the adult children. We were talking on the way in about my adult children. We're on the other end of that, and it's a little tricky, but it's good. So they're little, and people always say enjoy them when they're little. They grow up so fast, but it's kind of annoying when people say that when you're little and you're up to your eyeballs and little kid stuff.
Yes, I always have to forewarn anyone who ever rides in the car with me, because anytime you open any door on my car, it's a waterfall of like goldfish and dirty clothes and water bottles and like Happy Meal wrappers, and I'm just sorry in advance.
Yes.
It's not clean. I mean, I can vacuum it out all I want,
yeah,
or like pay someone else to vacuum it out all I want, it will never stay clean.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I always, and I think as moms, I think we all have to give each other some grace. And I think we do. I think we're harder on ourselves than anybody else is on us. Don't you think?
Yeah. And I think I feel like I heard someone or some mom say, either I'm clean and my hair is washed, my kids are clean and their hair is washed, my house is clean, or my car is clean. It's impossible to have all four.
Yeah. And for sure, that car is going to be the last thing on the list.
Yes. Yeah, that definitely.
As long as it's
bottom.
As long as it's running.
Yes.
The cleanliness is kind of going to be at the bottom. Oh, it's fun. I love. So talk to me a little bit about being a mom. What's your favorite thing? What's your hardest thing?
My favorite thing is honestly having, I mean, not that I ever doubted that my parents loved me unconditionally, and I always felt that I loved them unconditionally. But then when I had my own children, I mean, it really brought it to life even more. And I guess the love that they give me is the best part for me, because it's just so, I don't know, pure and exuberant, and they always get happy to see me come home. Well, except maybe my oldest sometimes. I mean, heaven forbid the TV's going, then she's like, oh, hey, it's you. But if it's off, then they're always usually pretty excited when I come home. They just love life so much. I mean, they get excited over, you know, riding their bikes outside, whereas me, I can be like, eh, that does not sound that fun, or whatever it is. I mean, they get excited over everything, and I feel like their excitement helps me to be excited.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. Do you still have a lot of siblings around? Do you still get together with siblings? And is your how's your family doing there?
Yeah, all of my siblings currently are in Utah. I mean,
oh,
we're
that's
all
great.
Probably within an hour and a half of each other. I mean, that's probably the biggest stretch of distance between any two of us.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we still get together and have a good time. And, you know, my parents are both, you know, living their different lives, mm-hmm. and they're both doing well. So I think that's all I can ask for.
Oh, absolutely. That's neat. It's neat to have your siblings so close and everybody close. That's hard to do when you have a big family like you do and like I do, to have them really close together. Let's talk a little bit about your work that you're doing now. So you've had your foundation and you've been doing work there. And talk a little bit about your foundation, what it is, what it is now, what it was, what it is now, and the things you're working on now.
So my dad and I started the Elizabeth Smart Foundation back in 2011, and we wanted it to focus on prevention, education against sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and education for women and children on the topic. And then over the years, it's become more and more active. And recently, just this past January, we merged with the Maloof Foundation. And we had done a number of projects with them over the years. And actually, I first heard about Maloof was when I was traveling around the country giving presentations. And a lot of times, as I'm sure you are well experienced and versed in, there's Q&A after doing a presentation. And people, one of the common questions I'd get asked is, how do we recognize human trafficking, or how do we recognize signs of abuse? And, you know, there were answers that I could give, but I mean, I was not trafficked. So speaking directly to what to look for felt a little bit foreign. So I felt like I needed to become better educated in that. So I started, you know, scrolling, searching, studying up on the internet, and I came across this website called iamonwatch.org. Mm-hmm. And it was this mini course on how to recognize signs of human trafficking. And so I went through and I took the course, and it was really good. It was really well done. It was really well thought out. It covered a lot of different areas that maybe when you think of human trafficking, you don't immediately think of. And, you know, I took all of the, I answered all the questions along the way. And when I got to the end of it, I remember wondering, who is this? Where did this come from? I feel like I should have heard of this before. I mean, I feel like it would have shown up like on my plate as opposed to me like having to go out and hunt it down. And I don't honestly remember. I mean, it's been a number of years ago that I took it or that I first took it. And I don't remember if it was on the website, but somehow I was able to track it back to this organization called Maloof. And then lo and behold, they're based in Utah. And I just remember sitting there having my mind completely blown, thinking, how have I not heard of these people? I mean, I feel like I've been very active in this space of advocacy, and I feel like I typically hear about a lot of the organizations that are really at the forefront of this, or we cross paths, or, you know, we end up collaborating or something. How have I not heard about them? So that just kind of began me anyway, keeping my eye on them. And then as time passed, I mean, they did reach out and they introduced me to what they were doing. And we started collaborating more and more. And I was so impressed because they are local, but they really have a global view. I mean, they really want to change the world for better for survivors. And I've just been so impressed, so much so that the end of last summer, they approached me and they said, well, Elizabeth, you know what? We would really love to make our relationship a little bit deeper. And me sitting there, I was like, oh, what do you mean? And they're like, well, we'd really love to take it as deep as you're willing to go. And I was like, okay, well, can you just speak like openly to me? Like, what are you thinking? They're like, well, actually, we would love you to come and join our foundations together. And given our past history and our past collaborations together, honestly, it was one of the easiest decisions I think I've ever made. And even beyond that, you know, I studied music. This is probably the more selfish side of me coming forward. I studied music in college. I did not study nonprofit. I didn't study business administration. I don't know how to, I don't know patent law or tax law, or there's so much I don't understand. I mean, it's been so great because now I can focus on the issues and the topics that I know about, that I can know I can help make a difference on. And together, we can change not just our local communities, but we can hopefully really make a global impact. And that really excites me. And I don't have to get caught up in trying to figure out, is this the right, am I filing this the correct way? Am I going to hear back from the IRS in like 5 months telling me I did it wrong? So it is a huge relief for me.
Yeah. Oh, that's, you know, and I don't think people really understand that I like you, I mean, education is my background. I studied education and I got into this world and I was doing an initiative, and all of a sudden I'm trying to figure out how to start a 501c3 and do a foundation so that I can do the work that we're trying to do. Because, you know, people may not know this, but I don't get money from the government. I don't get money from the state to really run any kind of foundation or do the initiative that I'm doing. And so I totally get what you're saying. Like, we've just gone through that this year, trying to set up a 501c3 and a nonprofit organization to do the work that we're doing and to gather money. And yeah, we were probably a little behind on the audit process and all that stuff. And we're like, we're trying to figure all this out. So I totally get that you can now just focus on the work that you're doing, which is incredible.
I mean, it's really intimidating. I mean, there's so much more to running a nonprofit, a 501c3, than just keeping your vision and focus on your initiatives. I mean, there are so many other moving parts. And so for me, you know, having the opportunity to combine with the Maloof Foundation and recognize the fact that together we will be able to do so much more. And also, maybe selfishly, now that I don't have to deal with figuring the nitty gritty out with, I don't know, payroll or accounting or taxes or or anything in that business world, it's been just a wonderful, I would almost say blissful decision.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I want to continue this conversation as we talk a little bit more about what comes next and what your experiences have been around legislation and things that have been passed and is it working? I want to have that conversation when we come right back.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back here and so honored to have Elizabeth Smart here on First Lady and Friends. And I want to talk about, you know, your story of trauma is well documented and I don't know that anybody doesn't know about it. But and so we won't get into that so much as what came next, because you're doing advocacy work and your family's done a lot of advocacy work as a result of your experience. I know there's a lot of, there's been some legislation passed. Let's first of all talk about that and the things that you were able to push forward legislatively and sort of how that came about, what that process was like, and maybe if you feel like it's doing what it was supposed to do.
Sure. So for me, it started off, honestly, it's like wading into the shallow end of the swimming pool. My dad, he really blazed the trail for me. He would be involved in legislation and he would come home and he'd say, Elizabeth, what do you think about this? Or how do you feel about that? Or, you know, what is... How do you feel like, do you feel like this could have been different for you or would this have helped you? And then depending on my answer, I'd be like, well, you know, I'm actually working on this piece of legislation. Do you want to come? Do you have any interest in coming? And usually if it was something that I had a strong answer to, I usually felt like I wanted to go. And so I've done it on both the local and national scale, where I've gone up and met with the different, you know, senators or congressmen and lobbied for legislation. And I feel like we have come a long way since my rescue. I think that we still have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of so many victims and survivors and... If they're found, if they come back alive, the focus typically shifts away from them and onto, well, we need to punish this person. And the sad thing about that is that about only 25 out of every 1,000 cases that go to court actually are prosecuted. Mm. I mean, it's abysmal. It's That's terrible.
Sad. That's so sad.
And so, but I mean, the court system for victims is a hellish place. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the common steps that victims experience when going through a court case is they're put on the stand and every mistake of their life is brought forward to show that they're maybe not the most credible victim or to say, well, they're not perfect. Mm-hmm. Somehow they contributed to this. And that's not fair because it really doesn't matter what your background is or what you did before this happens. I mean,
yeah,
people make mistakes all the time. But nobody deserves to be trafficked or abused or raped. And it can be so difficult to then, you know, not just come forward and speak out about what happened. It's terrifying to make a report to the police. It's terrifying to move forward in a court case and then to have like your own, your personal integrity. I mean, more or less destroyed. Mm-hmm. And then to realize that your chances of actually winning a case are very slim. I mean, 25 out of 1,000. That's terrible.
Yeah. So do a lot of the victims, survivors, do they make the calculation that it's not worth it to get on this town?
Many victims, they never report. Mm. They never report and they don't press charges because they already feel like it's an uphill battle. I have spoken in all 50 states, and whenever there's been an opportunity for me to mingle after the presentation, I've always, without fail, had people approach me and say, you know, the same thing happened to me or something similar happened to me when I was younger, but I've never shared it with anyone. Or I told my mom and she didn't believe me, or I told my dad, or I told someone and they didn't believe me. So there is always, I would say, an element of fear and doubt as to whether or not people are believed. And honestly, I feel like if I had to pinpoint something that made the biggest difference for me in my healing and moving forward is that I was never doubted on a grand scale. I mean, there's always mean people out there. Yeah. There's always people who will hate you no matter what. And so, yes, I've dealt with people who don't like me for whatever reason.
Unbelievable.
But okay. Or who have called me a liar or whatever. Wow. I mean, we all deal with it. Mm. But I've never had that on a grand scale. Overwhelmingly, I've been supported. My family always believed me. And so I feel like for me, that allowed me to really let go of the past and move into my future because I could, because I was believed and supported. And so I feel like that is one of the most important things that we can give our victims and survivors. And actually, that is one of my nearest and dearest causes. Every November, we run a campaign through the entire month called We Believe You. And on one side, it is to help victims and survivors know that we do believe them, that there's a whole community, that there are thousands of people out here who do believe victims and will support them and love them and be there for them. On the flip side of it, I mean, you know, got your degree in education, and you probably know better than anyone how much safety education kids are given. You know, don't cross the street without looking both ways. If you catch on fire, you stop, drop, and roll. But 1 out of 3 women will be sexually abused in their lifetime. Have you ever been given any information on what to do or how you should respond? And no one has.
Yeah.
No one has. And so the other side, the flip side to letting victims know that we believe them, is that we want to provide education and resources out there to communities so that they know how to respond. Because whether you consciously know of someone that you can think of, oh, so-and-so, she was raped or not, you do actually know someone, just because statistically the odds are so high. Yeah. You definitely know someone, and you probably know more than one person. You probably know a whole bunch of people who have, whether they've come forward and admitted it or said it out loud, voiced it, or whether they've stayed silent. You do know someone who has been abused.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so true. And you know, we've had podcasts, we've had Supriya folks on here before, and we talked about this a little bit, of this idea of my thought always goes to, you know, first of all, yes, we need to take better care of the people that have experienced this trauma, and we need to do better at believing them, and we need to do all the things that create an environment of healing. And then can we turn our attention also to how do we stop this from happening so more and more women and children don't have to be survivors. They don't have to go through this. And I guess, you know, some of the legislation you've worked through, one of them was the Amber Alert So talk a little bit about that. And do you feel like this is working? Do you feel like the Amber Alert and the system and this piece of legislation, is it doing what it's intended to do?
So I was involved in the Amber Alert pretty quickly after I was rescued. And I do feel like it is a powerful tool, although it is, I mean, there's a certain amount of requirements that have to be met before they will issue an Amber Alert. And time is of the essence. I mean, as soon as someone disappears, you want to get the word out as quickly and as loudly and as widespread as possible. So if it takes 24 hours to get an Amber Alert issued, that's difficult because those first 24 hours are really the most important. That's your greatest chance of rescuing them. I mean, after 24 hours, your chances of finding them alive, they decrease, I mean, rapidly, I mean, drastically.
Yeah.
So it is a powerful tool. And yes, I do believe it is doing good. But could it do better? Of course. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know we had a little, there's some issues with it in the state of Utah because they were, it's just tough. It's so tough because, you know, if the Amber Alert is going off all the time, you start to tune out. And so that's the difficulty. And, you know, there were a lot of, I think there was some issues with non-custodial parents. And anyway, it's a whole thing to work through and it's really tough. But I do think you're exactly right. I think we can always continue to improve the way we do this. And based on people like you who understand how it works, we need your voices, you know, your voice to help us to understand how to be better on that. Is there any other legislation that you sort of championed or helped bring about that you feel like is doing really good work in this space?
I mean, I was also involved with my dad on the Adam Walsh Safety and Protection Act and the Sex Offender Registry. And then locally, a few years ago, my dad and I, we went up and we were pushing another piece of legislation forward, and it was an opt-out as opposed to an opt-in. So when your child's in school and a teacher sends home a permission slip saying, you know, if you want your child to attend this, what is it called? Assembly. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, attend this presentation, you need to sign this permission slip. So instead of having to sign it for them to attend it, it was really the opposite. So having to sign it if you did not want them to attend. Okay. Because it's just so easy for children to fall through the cracks. And if they experience abuse at home, are their guardians going to sign a permission slip for them to attend a presentation on abuse and what to do? I mean, it's hard to say, but in my mind, it would make sense for them not to. Yeah. And so being able to have the opposite, where I totally respect parents who want to take this issue on at home, and that's great. That's fantastic. I mean, really, it's an issue that should be approached from all sides. I mean, it should be talked about at home, and it should be talked about at school. It should be talked about everywhere, because unfortunately, abuse does happen everywhere. And being able to recognize it and knowing what your options are and knowing what to do next are huge, because if it's coming from a figure of authority or power, or maybe they have a lot of respect, it can be very intimidating. It can be terrifying to be that small person saying, well, actually, no.
Yeah.
So I do feel like that was a useful piece of legislation. And then most recently with the Maloof Foundation, I can't even think of exact wording, but it's been in one of the most recent sessions with offenders who are looking at child sexual abuse material online, and stricter guidelines for sentencing on that. Mm. Because That is not okay. I've heard people in the past say, oh, well, it's a victimless crime. And I can't understand how they think that. You are actually watching some innocent soul being victimized repeatedly, and you're getting enjoyment out of that. I mean, that is so wrong, so morally wrong on every level. It 100% is a crime that does have victims, and you're watching the victims.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's expand a little bit on this idea of prevention and how we talk about getting children in a place where they know what to do next. And let's continue that conversation when we come right back. We are back here on First Lady and Friends with Elizabeth Smart. We're so happy to have you here. And these are such important conversations. And your perspective is just so incredibly valuable. And you've pushed through, like you've talked about, this incredible legislation. First of all, I have this question. This is kind of off topic, but like, did your dad have experience in legislative affairs? Did he learn on the job too?
He learned on the job, and he just felt like no child should experience what I experienced. And he didn't want to see any other child experience that. And he didn't want to see the family experience, you know, the secondary trauma that comes with it. Because I mean, if you're someone you love goes through immense pain, or you know, is a victim of a crime or a violent crime, I mean, you experience trauma as well. And I mean, it can be catastrophic. I mean, it's not, when you hear the term secondary trauma, you might just think, oh, well, it's not as intense as, I don't know, first degree trauma. I'm not even sure. Primary trauma.
Yeah.
But I mean, it very much can be.
I mean, and I think all of us watching what happened to you and your family, I think most people just like the heartbreak. We all sort of, it was one of those things where it was like, this could totally happen to me. I mean, you know, a lot of the crimes or things that happen, you're like, oh, that happens to, you know, that happens to somebody else. I don't know. We just looked at it, this, I think all of us, and said, this, my gosh, this could happen to anyone. And how do we prevent that? So let's talk a little bit about this prevention piece. First of all, this legislation and these things that you've worked on, would they have helped you had they been in place before now? And maybe what do you think does help the most to sort of keep children safe from these crimes?
Ultimately, the only way to eliminate rape, to eliminate sexual violence or abuse, is for rapists to stop raping, yeah, abusers to stop abusing. That's really the only way that we will eliminate it. And that sounds really depressing coming out of my mouth. But we can... There are a lot of things that we can do to make us a little bit less at risk. Many predators, they look for vulnerability. They look for that opportunity. They look for maybe children who are a little bit more on the shy side or a little bit quieter, or maybe their home life is struggling a little bit, or maybe they're being bullied at school. I mean, whatever it is,
you know,
they look for vulnerability, and that's what they look for. So one of the best things that we can do is to start having these conversations earlier and more often and from lots of different places. I think of my childhood, and honestly, I didn't know anyone who was raped. Nobody ever talked to me about it. I didn't actually know the difference between rape and enthusiastic consensual sex. Mm-hmm. To me, it was all the same thing. So that when I was eventually raped, I felt terrible. It felt like the same thing. And you know, being raised Mormon, mm-hmm, very active, and not having those conversations where there's always a lot of emphasis been put on staying a virgin until marriage, no sex before marriage. I mean, that added a whole extra layer of guilt and shame and feelings of worthlessness and filthiness. So having these conversations early and often, they are very important. And it's hard and it's scary. And frankly, I'm at the beginning of having those conversations with my kids. And even now, I keep thinking, how am I going to get into this topic? And I mean, with my oldest daughter, I'm like, okay, by the end of the summer, I'm going to have taken the next step in this conversation, because we talk about safety all the time, and she'll roll her eyes. My other two will roll their eyes. They'll say, "We know, Mama. You just want us to be safe." But now I feel like my oldest is getting to a point where she's ready for the next step in that conversation. And honestly, it terrifies me. Yeah. I mean, it does. I'm nervous. I've given myself this time frame where it has to happen so that I will follow through, and then we can continue talking about it until she's ready for the next step. And the more knowledge and probably more details, you know, with each and every step, because all my kids, they are the most precious part of my life. Mm-hmm. And if anything happened to them, I mean, it would break my heart. It would destroy me. And I mean, I feel like, and I'm sure my parents felt that way about me, that they would rather go through anything, didn't matter what it was, then see me suffer that way. And I feel the same way about my children. And so I want them to be aware of what does happen in this world, what is possible. And then I want them to be able to recognize the red flags should there ever appear any, so that they know what to do, so that they can come tell me, or they can come tell my husband, or they can, you know, if they trust their teacher, they could go tell their teacher. But I want them to know that we are here for them, that we will support them, that if they don't feel comfortable, that there's a reason they don't feel comfortable, and they shouldn't just push it aside and think they're making something out of nothing, because that's not right. And I mean, it's, as a parent, like, I'm not a professional parent. You know, I've only been doing it for 7 years. I am so open to advice.
I don't think there is such a thing, thank goodness.
I feel like I'm more often than not flying by the seat of my pants. But some of the things that other people have told me that I feel like is helpful and is very good to know is helping our children to set boundaries, and then us as parents and adults respecting their boundaries. So, for example, my husband is from Scotland, so we have a lot of family who lives far away, and they don't get to see them very often. And so when we do get together, it's easy to be like, okay, you know, go give, you know, Uncle so-and-so like a kiss now, or go give him a hug. Come on, you never get to see him. It'd be so nice of you to give him a hug, or it'd be so nice of you to give him a kiss. And it's easy to be put in that situation to like want to pressure them into showing affection. But in the long run, that actually is instilling the message in them that they don't want to, but we're telling them that they have to, and making them disregard their own boundaries. Maybe that was their boundary. They didn't feel comfortable, you know, giving a certain uncle or family member a hug or a kiss. They didn't want to. And yet I'm sitting there saying, you need to. That kind of cancels out the whole idea of boundaries in children's head, that the boundaries that they set can be respected and should be respected. And that, you know, I tell my children all the time, like, nobody, if anyone ever touches you, you need to tell me. Yeah. If anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable, you need to tell me. But if I'm making them feel uncomfortable by forcing them to hug someone they don't want to hug, why would they then tell me in return? So it's building that trust with your child, helping them to understand that it's okay to have boundaries. It's good to have boundaries, and that as parents and adults, that we respect their boundaries so that they can tell us if something heaven forbid, something happens. So it is important, but then also giving them the tools to know what to do. Once again, heaven forbid, if something does happen, so that instead of just being like, he told me to keep it a secret, or she told me to keep it a secret, I'm not supposed to tell anyone. I'll get in trouble if I tell someone, or my parents will get in trouble, or or my sister will be hurt, or they'll go after my brothers. I mean, those are very common threats. They're very real threats to children, to victims across the board. And it's a lot of reasons as to why they may not speak out, why they might not share what's happened to them. And so helping them to have these conversations and recognize that this behavior is not acceptable, it's not okay, and helping them to understand that if this does happen, that they should tell you, or they should tell someone that they trust, that they can be protected, that you will have their corner, that's huge.
Yeah, that's such great advice. I think that's amazing. Those are really difficult conversations to have with your kid. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and we've had conversations all the way along, and they're not easy for me. It's hard to. I mean, you want to have those conversations, and I know they're important. It's hard for them. You don't want to sort of think that the world is ready to victimize you, but in some ways, sometimes it is. And so for them to be prepared, but also to understand what a loving, kind relationship can and should look like is such an important part of that as well. Do you think at some point, and maybe it's already happened, do you think you will share your experience with your children?
I mean, my children know. Okay. I mean, not extensive details, right, or anything, but they do know because they know that I'm not at home with them. And so they'll ask me, where are you going? Why are you going? Why do you have to do that? I don't want you to go. Can't you just cancel? And so I have had to explain to them, well, this is what I do because I don't want what happened to me to happen to anyone else. Mm. And that, of course, leads to, well, what happened to you? Yeah. So those conversations have already begun. That none of them could tell you extensive detail about anything. But my oldest, I mean, she could tell you the most. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she could tell you that a bad man came and he took me away and he hurt me and I was rescued one day. She could tell you that. Mm. Maybe a little bit more, but not much.
That's incredible. And I think it's really an important conversation for all of our children to have, for us to have with our children. As an educator, I we were taught to look for those signs and for people. And I just remember my daughter from the earliest ages. Thankfully, I mean, I guess thankfully or not, she is who she is. So I am thankful for that. But she's very assertive. She's the youngest of, you know, three boys, and then she's the baby. And so she is very assertive. But I have tried to talk to her about that is good. But I also worry that we do have to teach those less assertive, a little bit shyer, you talked about, sometimes they are more victimized because that's what a predator looks for. How do you keep your kids' personalities while at the same time helping them to be assertive and to have this awareness of the way they need to create those boundaries?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think that's why it does come down to each parent to take this very responsibly and very seriously, because nobody knows your child, hopefully, better than you do. And hopefully you know them well enough to know what they're ready for, and so you can gauge how much they can handle. And I think, I always want to have a strong relationship with my children. And hopefully by having these uncomfortable conversations a lot, first, they'll become less uncomfortable. Yeah. And secondly, that builds that trust and that knowledge in them, that they feel like they have the tools that they need, but they don't necessarily need to be scared of life.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, that's so great. And something, a balance I'm trying to...
Aren't we all?
I know.
Oh, the joys of parenting.
I mean, I feel like I'm in over my head.
I know, right? I'm still in over my head, and I'm 23 years in. So it's tough. Parenting is, I think, will always be our toughest job, and the job that never ends, which is really good and really hard sometimes.
Absolutely.
And I think you're doing a wonderful job. I mean, you really are addressing these things, and you really are you are a more quiet personality, and you've become just this really strong, powerful voice for so many people. So I really appreciate that work that you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Before we end here, I have just, I think it would be fun, and we haven't done this for a long time, but I think it would be fun. Just a few little rapid fire questions that we'll do right here at the end. Okay. So name, maybe three of your favorite sounds.
When I come home and my little three-year-old and, well, all of them actually, but definitely my little three-year-old, like, come running up to me and being like, Mommy. I love that. Also silence when they go to bed.
Yes.
The lack of sound, maybe.
Yes.
But knowing that they're alive and safe.
Yes.
Just sleeping.
Breathing.
Breathing. Yes. And my other favorite sound... This is going to sound so silly, but I have an Apple Watch, and when all three of my rings close.
Yes. Right? I love that. I'm so accomplished.
Yes, I did it. I did it today.
Like, it's like 11 o'clock, and you're like, oh, I need to stand up one more time.
Yes.
I love that. Maybe let's ask, what podcasts or TV shows do you binge?
I binge the British Bake Off.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
So great.
Love it.
So great.
Love it.
Yeah. And your husband's probably like, yes, those are my people.
Well, he'll watch it with me the first time. But when it's like the second through 100th time watching it, he's less excited about it.
I have to say, I am like completely addicted to any British TV. I don't know if it's just from my like ancestry or what, but... I actually subscribe to BritBox.
Oh, well, so do we.
It's the best. And I just find it so delightful. So,
yes.
So if you could talk to one person in history, who would it be?
Oh, I think I'd be very interested in speaking to Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah.
My namesake. Just kidding.
Yes, of course.
She's not, but I would be interested. I mean, she was such a powerful woman in history and... Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to speak to her.
Yeah, yeah, that would be amazing. So we'll end with this one.
And I mean Queen Elizabeth back in the day.
Yes,
I mean,
yes,
I'm sure I modern day Queen Elizabeth would be very interesting.
And a whole host of history.
Elizabeth Tudor, yes, like way back when.
Yes, oh yeah, yeah, for sure. So interesting. A snapshot of a regular moment in your life that brings you true joy.
Probably no makeup, hair in a messy bun, athleisure, and hanging out on the sofa, probably watching something off of Disney Plus for the billionth time with my kids, eating popcorn.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you, Elizabeth. This has just been really enlightening and just a real privilege to get to know you better. And I know our listeners will be so appreciative of you and hearing your story. And we just are so thrilled to have gotten to have you here today. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth also has a podcast. It's called Smart Talks. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts. Also, check out MaloufFoundation.org and ElizabethSmartFoundation.org. Thanks for being a friend.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Smartin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.